we will have to leave this planet, and we're going to leave it, and it's going to make this planet better. And we'll come and go, and people who want to stay will stay, and we'll move all heavy, dirty industry off Earth, where, by the way, we will be able to do it much more effectively. We must go back to the moon, and this time to stay.
That is Jeff Bezos, the Amazon CEO and founder of the Blue Origin Space Venture. He was talking this weekend at the National Space Society with Alan Boyle, GeekWire's aerospace and science editor. Bezos had just received the group's Gerard K. O'Neill Memorial Award, named after the late American physicist whose work helped to shape Bezos' approach. It was a fascinating discussion about the future of humanity with someone who is not only thinking, but spending deeply to usher in a new era of space travel. On this special edition of the GeekWire podcast, The Other Side of Jeff Bezos, we'll play the conversation for you in its entirety, starting with this surprise announcement that Bezos made before answering the first question from GeekWire's Alan Boyle.
Does anybody here in this audience watch a TV show called The Expanse? Yeah! Have you heard of that? Do you guys know that the cast of The Expanse is here in the room? Could you guys stand up, please? Can you stand up? And all right, settle down.
I think you got some fans in here.
So I was talking to the cast actually just half an hour ago, right before dinner started, and I was telling them that we were working hard at Amazon to save The Expanse, but it wasn't a done deal yet. And during dinner, 10 minutes ago, I just got word that The Expanse is saved. The Rocinante is safe, and we'll be a prime original in the coming seasons. So we're looking forward. And if you haven't seen the show is extraordinary, and these guys are unbelievably talented. So I'm glad you're going to get to continue.
Well, I think we got our headline here. So mission accomplished.
Oh, we could keep
What's
going.
What's the weather
that's,
like? Yeah.
That's just setting the bar.
So we were going to talk about O'Neill, but why don't you talk a little bit, since we're on the subject of The Expanse, talk about the science fiction that has formed you. I know you're a big fan of The Expanse and the Culture series and Philip K. Dick.
Absolutely. And, I grew up reading science fiction. I spent my summers in a small town in South Texas called Cotulla, 3,000 people, about halfway between San Antonio and Laredo, and they had a tiny little town library. And in that library were about 300 science fiction books that one guy in town had donated to the library. He'd basically donated his entire science fiction collection to the library. And it probably was 10% of the library was science fiction. And I just, over the course of many summers, plowed my way through all of them. And they were the classics. It's Asimov and Heinlein and all of the people that you know. And today I continue with my science fiction reading habit and find it very mind-expanding. It always makes me think. And so, the Culture series is certainly, in terms of more modern science fiction, one of my absolute favorites.
It must be gratifying to be able to bring that through.
We're not quite at that level technologically yet.
Not yet.
We've got no sentient starships. We've got a lot of work to do before we get there, but it's a kind of interesting, there's a utopian element to it that I find very attractive.
So you've talked a lot about millions of people working in space,
and
that's O'Neill's vision as well. How do we get there? Maybe you
well,
can talk
I, it, you know,
back up to but the story.
For sure,
want.
Asking me about O'Neill, Professor O'Neill was very formative for me. And it started, I read The High Frontier in high school. I read it multiple times, and I was already primed. And as soon as I read it, it made sense to me. It seemed very clear that planetary surfaces were not the right place for an expanding civilization inside our solar system. For one, they're just not that big. There's another argument that I like to make too, which is they're hard to get to. And when we build our own colonies, we can do them in near-Earth vicinity. So, because people are going to want to come back to Earth. Very few people, for a long time anyway, are going to want to abandon Earth altogether. Earth is going to be a very important place to be able to come back to. You're going to want to come and go. And if you have very few launch opportunities and need a lot of delta V to get to a planetary surface, that's going to make it very difficult to come and go. That's going to be more a place where you go and stay. And there are a lot of other problems with planetary surfaces. But the main one is you just can't, they're not big enough. And we have resources to build room for a trillion humans in this solar system. And when we have a trillion humans, we'll have 1,000 Einsteins and 1,000 Mozarts. It'll be a way more interesting place to live. The alternative, by the way, if we stay on this planet, is not necessarily extinction. We could defend this planet, but the alternative is stasis. We will have to stop growing. Which I think is a very bad future. It's not the future that I want for my grandchildren or my grandchildren's grandchildren. And I doubt anybody in this room wants that for their descendants. We have ever-improving lives in large part because we use ever-expanding amounts of energy. And you can take baseline energy uses on Earth today, compounded at just a few percent a year for just a few hundred years, not very long. The power of compounding is very non-human and it throws people, but just at a few hundred years, we will have to cover the entire surface of the Earth and solar cells if we want to continue to grow our energy usage. And keep in mind that all the things that you like, hospitals, air travel, all these things, you know, modern childbirth where children don't die, all of these things are, we use a lot of energy to do these things. And we've been getting efficient at using energy with every passing decade, and still we use more. Our metabolic rate as an animal is 100 watts. That's how much the human body needs. If you take about 2,000 calories of food intake a day and convert that to watts, that's our power, our metabolic power. Our civilizational metabolic rate as members of the developed world is 11,000 watts. So do we want that to continue or do we want to freeze that in time? If we freeze it, you know, by the way, there are billions of people who don't yet enjoy the 11,000 watts that the people in this room enjoy. So we will have to leave this planet, and we're going to leave it, and it's going to make this planet better. And we'll come and go, and people who want to stay will stay. There'll be some restrictions here. It will end up being zoned light industry and residential, and we'll move all heavy, dirty industry off Earth, where, by the way, we will be able to do it much more effectively with 24/7 solar power. The Earth is not a very good place to do heavy industry. It's convenient for us right now. But in the not too distant future, I mean, I'm talking, you know, decades, maybe 100 years, it'll start to be easier to do a lot of the things that we currently do on Earth in space, because we'll have so much energy. So, and then we can send the vitamins down to Earth. That's going to be the great inversion. The beginning thing is we'll get bulk materials in space, and we'll have to send all the vitamins up, you know, integrated circuits and things like that. We'll have to send all of those up into space, but eventually that will invert and we will send the vitamins down to Earth.
So this sounds like a great future. Almost sounds like you're painting a fantastic long-term vision.
It is.
But how do we get from here to there? Blue Origin is bringing down the cost of access to space.
You have to lower the cost of access to do these grand things that we're talking about. And by the way, this is not something that we can choose to do. This is something we must do. We need to do a better job of communicating how important this is, because this mission is so big. We need the world to support it. And the people in this room are part of educating the world on why this is a must do and not a fun to do. We need to do this.
So
how do you do it? Yeah. You do it step by step. Our motto at Blue Origin is Gradatum Frosteter, step by step ferociously. And by the way, for about a year, our motto was just Gradatum. I made that up because step by step is so important to me. And then I realized that's not enough. It has to be step by step ferociously. And so that's where the ferociter came from. But it's a, because we don't have a lot of time. We do have to hurry. And we can use, I spent 3 years at the beginning of, in the year 2003, looking at all the different ways you might get off Earth with different, more exotic means of propulsion, and came to the conclusion after 3 years that chemical propulsion is the right way to get off of Earth. It's actually a very good way. And the only problem is the rockets need to be reusable. And we can dramatically lower the cost of access to space, which will then allow us to start this long process of moving all heavy industry. And it won't be done by one company. It won't be done by just Blue Origin. It won't be done by just NASA. It won't be done by in any particular. This is going to take thousands of companies working in concert over many decades. One of the great problems in business is that people have a kind of a sports metaphor in their head that that competitive companies, that there's a winner and a loser. But business isn't like sports. In sports, when two teams enter an arena, one leaves the winner and one leaves the loser. In fact, most sports have a lot of exotic mechanisms to make absolutely sure that's true. They have sudden death, or they have whatever they have
extra
some
innings.
They have some extra innings. They have some method of making sure there is never a tie. I think cricket is a weird exception to this rule. They can play for 5 days and end in a tie. This is they're going to have to change that if they ever want it to be televised in this country.
Hey.
But that is a but mostly, that's way off track, sorry. We don't have time for that kind of aside.
I should be harder on you, Jeff.
Yeah, you got to control me.
Yeah.
So, really, if you think about it, in a sporting match, somebody leaves the winner and somebody leaves the loser. We all grow up in high school and playing sports and playing team sports, and we watch sports on TV. And this model is that there's a winner and a loser is so deeply ingrained in our head. But in business, industries rise and fall. It is not a zero-sum game. It is often that there are multiple winners, and that's what we've seen on the internet. Thousands of companies have been successful on the internet of all scales and sizes, some very large like Amazon, and some medium-sized and some small, but it's a big group of companies. Mm-hmm. And the reason all those companies can thrive on the internet is because the heavy lifting was already in place. Facebook could be started by two kids in a dorm room, and now is a giant megacorporation after just a little more than a decade. Two kids in a dorm room today cannot do that as a space entrepreneur. You cannot make a giant space company in your dorm room. Not today. And the reason is that the heavy lifting infrastructure isn't in place. When I started Amazon, I didn't have to build a payment system. It existed. It was the credit card. I didn't have to build a transportation network. It existed. It was called Deutsche Post, Royal Mail, the UPS, FedEx,
right.
And so on.
USPS.
Mm-hmm. And likewise, I didn't have to get a computer on every desk. That was already done. Microsoft had worked on that and laid that heavy infrastructure along with IBM and Intel and Apple and a bunch of others. And that all those things would be multiple tens of billions, in some cases hundreds of billions of dollars worth of CapEx that no 20-year-old in their dorm room would get to deploy. That's what it is right now to be a space entrepreneur. You get millions of dollars, not billions of dollars, but the things you want to do currently would cost billions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to change that and make it more like the last 20 years of the internet, where you saw unbelievable dynamism. And then when we have that entrepreneurial dynamism in space, you will see how fast this vision that I painted, which is this is really the Jerry O'Neill vision I was deeply influenced by, that vision will happen so fast once we have that dynamism. Mm-hmm. So my role is, and it's important, it's the most important work I'm doing. It's crucial. My role is to help build that heavy lifting infrastructure because I have the financial assets to do that. And that will set things up for this dynamic entrepreneurial explosion that will lead to this Jerry O'Neill world.
That is Jeff Bezos speaking with Alan Boyle, GeekWire's aerospace and science editor, in Los Angeles at the National Space Society on Saturday, May 26th, 2018. There's a lot more to hear. We're playing the conversation in its entirety this week. You're listening to GeekWire, and we'll be right back after this break. Welcome back. Let's rejoin Jeff Bezos in conversation with GeekWire's Alan Boyle at the National Space Society.
I know that you've said that you basically turn in $1 billion worth of
Amazon
stock.
Yeah, I sell about $1 billion of stock a year.
And put that mostly toward Blue Origin.
I put it mostly toward Blue Origin.
Now, Rick Tomlinson, who I think is in the room, once said that you and Elon Musk are making a charitable contribution to the future, and that's what that $1 billion represents. Is it charity, or do you see it as a business?
No, it's both. And so most things are, the question really is, are you improving the world? And you can do that in many models. You can do that in government, you can do that in nonprofit, and you can do it in commercial enterprise. And is the world better because Apple pioneered the smartphone? Yes, I think so. Is the world better because, you know, Boeing makes an all carbon fiber 787 that's more fuel efficient than anything we've ever seen? I think so. So if I am the guy in charge of the Boeing 787, I feel unbelievably good about my contribution to society. And so that goes on and on and on. There is so much value in the world is created, so much wealth in the world is created by the fair exchange of value. And that's what goes on. That's what commerce is. It's the fair exchange of value. And people invent new things, and they pioneer new things, and the world gets better. And some things can't be done in that model. And then if they can't, you know, so like if you look at the Bill Gates Foundation, they do such a good job of focusing only on things where there are market failures, where it's just not going to work. You know, there is no market for room temperature vaccines. Nobody, the people who don't have refrigerators cannot develop room temperature vaccines. So the market is never going to do that. Who's going to pay for that? So that has to be, you know, most vaccines need to be refrigerated, and for us, that's fine. If you live in a developed country, you have refrigeration. It's not a problem. So that's a market failure. And where there are market failures, you need to use a nonprofit model, or you need to use a government model. And I think, by the way, the way to think about this is start with the mission and work backwards and figure out which of those models is better for the mission. But no matter what your mission is, have some notion in your head. Forget the model of whether it's government or nonprofit or profit. Ask yourself the more important question: is my mission improving the world? Mm-hmm. And are you sure about it? And seek to disconfirm that all the time. And if you can, change your mission. So, do something new.
So it's going to be 50 years since Buzz Aldrin and his friend Neil Armstrong made that landing on the moon. And at that time, you remember that, you were, what, 5 years old?
I was 5 years old. I watched Buzz and Neil step onto the surface of the moon. I remember it very clearly. I remember how excited my family was. Black
was
and white TV.
I was a little bit older, and I remember thinking, this is it. You know, we're going to be going to the moon. We're going to be going to Mars. We're going to be going on and on. Is the space effort a market failure? Is that why you have to do
well,
this?
Well, yes, in a way. It was a government program. It wasn't a, you know, if you look at the Apollo program, it was never a market. There was no market there. It was a market failure, and the government stepped in and did it. There are other pieces of space, of course, that have found sustainable, kind of fair exchange of value, commerce, satellites, and, you know, communications satellites, and so on. But the Apollo program certainly had no real commercial value. I mean, it was done for very different reasons, and I think very good reasons for the time, and it's an extraordinary achievement of mankind, but it wasn't sustainable. And by the way, it was also pulled forward. We humans, this is the big we, should not have been able to do it in 1969. It was impossible. And we did it.
Impossible, Buzz.
Such things are not are not sustainable. And when something gets pulled forward out of sequence, it's unlikely to be sustainable. And so, but today, we must go back to the moon, and this time to stay.
So this comes back to the question of how we get from here to there. How do we get to the moon? And I know you've got the Blue Moon Lander. Is Blue Origin going to be merely a propulsion company, a delivery company? Are you going to build those habitats? What do you see as the role of Blue Origin in all this?
Well, so we're building the foundation first. We'll do stepwise whatever we need to do to get that vision to happen. Mm-hmm. So one of two things will happen. Either other people will take over the vision or I'll run out of money. Those are the two possibilities.
And I think it'll be a while before you run out of money.
Let's hope so. And so that vision is so important, and we'll do it step by step. The first step is you need to lower the cost of access to low Earth orbit. That's the first piece. We know how to do that. It's reusability. You have to reuse the vehicles. We have to figure out how to reuse the booster stage first and do that reliably. You have to fly it 100 times or more. It has to be truly operable reusability. The space shuttle was reusable, but only in a technical sense. The reality is that the refurbishment and inspection regime that the shuttle had to go through between flights drove the costs up very high. And so what you need is something much more like a commercial airliner, where you fly it, and you fly it again, and you fly it again, and you have certain intervals where you service it, and you have certain inspection regimes, and so on. Eventually, we want commercial airliner. I'd be very satisfied right now with this kind of life cycle cost you get with, say, a jet fighter. Mm-hmm. That would be a dramatic improvement over space vehicles, and that's where we need to head first. Once we have that, then yes, we need to build other, and Blue Origin will participate in these things, you know, lunar landers and other things, bigger vehicles. You know, we're not ready to do it yet. We're working on New Glenn, which is our orbital vehicle, but we have, you know, in our mind's eye, an even bigger vehicle called New Armstrong.
I was going to ask about that, how you saw that progressing.
Yeah, because you do need big rockets to do the kinds of things that we want to be able to do in space. You need to lift. Rockets, by the way, love to be big. A lot of the things scale really, really well. Small rockets are very hard. The only thing that's easy about a small rocket is they're easier to manufacture. And that's a big plus of small rockets. But when you think about the scaling laws, vertical landing, for example, gets easier the bigger the vehicle, because you're solving the inverted pendulum problem, and you know, you have more moment of inertia on a big vehicle, so it's actually easier to control it when it's tall and heavy.
Mm-hmm. So we're looking at a video of New Glenn.
Oh yeah, is this the New Glenn animation? Is that playing?
Yeah. So tell us about New Glenn, what the progress is, and
New Glenn Shepherd. Is being. We've been working on it for about 5 years. This is the second stage fairing separation. This is a satellite deployment sequence. The second stage is expendable. We've actually changed it since this video was made. Here comes the. I'll tell you in a second. This is the booster. Coming back in for reentry. It has strakes, which gives it good L over D so that it can fly back to the recovery ship. The ship is underway while it's being recovered, so it can use stabilizers to operate in heavy sea states. Has 6 landing gear. You saw them just deploy there in the video.
Have you bought the ship
and
yet?
And touchdown. Actually, yes, we have. And we're retrofitting it now.
Ah, okay.
So, I mean, it's just about to start. And this, this is another view of the landing. The second stage was going to be, that booster is powered by liquefied natural gas and liquid oxygen. Liquefied natural gas has turned out to be a really good propellant choice. Our BE-4 engine is 550,000 pounds of thrust, and there are 7 of them on the first stage. And we were going to have the second stage also be liquefied natural gas, but our BE-3U engine, which is the upper stage variant of our liquid hydrogen engine, made such fast progress that we decided to flip that mm-hmm. second stage to hydrogen, and it gives it way. Then the two-stage vehicle gets vastly improved performance.
And the BE-3 is also used on the New Shepard.
The BE-3 is used on our suborbital tourism vehicle called New Shepard.
I'm sure people want to hear about that. Maybe the cast of The Expanse would like to take a ride.
I think they would. We talked about that, you know, we should actually just film on location.
Yeah.
Might may drive the budget up a bit. We'll have to consider that.
You won't have to do quite so much wire work.
The woman who runs Amazon Studios, I'm already thinking she's not going to think that's a good idea. She's way too smart for that. But where were we, Alan?
Oh, what the time frame
new,
is.
New Shepard. So New
and
Shepard
much,
is a suborbital,
you know,
vehicle. We don't know the ticket price yet, so we haven't decided. By the way, sometimes people ask me, why do this suborbital mission? And the reason is practice. We're going to be able to fly that vehicle so often. And that engine, the BE-3 engine, is the same engine that is going to be in our orbital vehicle. And it'll get so much exercise and practice. It's going to be the most reliable liquid hydrogen engine in the world.
We'll be right back with some concluding thoughts from Jeff Bezos after this break. Welcome back to GeekWire. We're listening this week to a really incredible conversation between Jeff Bezos and GeekWire's Alan Boyle. Here's the final segment.
We're coming close to the end of the time, but I wanted to ask about the White House's lunar initiative.
Yeah.
And what you thought about that.
I'm a big fan. I don't like to skip steps, and I always thought that this idea of going to Mars without building a permanent base on the moon was, again, I believe it would end the same way Apollo did, where we would do it, there would be a ticker tape parade, and then 50 years of nothing. And so I hate that idea. It's out of sequence. And the special ops guys and the firefighters around the world have this great phrase, some of you may have heard it. They say, slow is smooth and smooth is fast. And that is true. Everything I've accomplished in my life has been because of that attitude. We don't skip steps. And we've got to go back to the moon. The moon is, we're so lucky to have the moon. It's so conveniently located. We now know things that we didn't know before. We know that there are volatiles trapped in the dark craters of the moon that are perpetually shaded. We know that there's water there, there's ice water there. There's probably other interesting things in those craters as well.
Lava tubes.
Somebody wants to go to a lava tube. Godspeed. I want you to do that. We also know that, you know, that this was actually forecast over 100 years ago, but we now know with great certainty and precision where, that on the rims of the craters, on the poles of the moon, there are places where you have almost perpetual sunlight. And so you can have, literally, there are some peaks where you only have about 10 hours of darkness per year. And those perpetual peaks of light are conveniently located right next to the perpetual dark areas where all these interesting volatiles reside. So it's almost like somebody set this up for us.
And I know that you are interested in a public-private partnership with NASA to go forward
with
this.
Yes, Blue Moon. We've proposed something called Blue Moon, which would be we would build a cargo lander that would take 5 metric tons of cargo to the lunar surface and precision land it in a soft, controlled way. And by the way, we'll do that, even if NASA doesn't do it, we'll do it eventually. But we could do it a lot faster if there were a partnership.
And what about the European Space Agency and their Moon Village concept?
Yes, I love the Moon Village concept. It's a better way, in my view. The integration that nations needed to cooperate on the International Space Station was very fine-grained. Everything had to work together. The Moon Village concept has a nice property in that everybody, it basically just says, look, everybody build their own lunar outpost, but let's do it close to each other. That way, like, if you need a cup of sugar, you can go over to the European Union lunar outpost and say, God, I'm out of eggs. What do you got?
As long as they're talking with each other, you know.
Well, but it's just really, it's sensible to be co-located because it would help with backup plans and emergencies. Obviously, I'm being silly with the eggs, but there would be real things like, can I have some oxygen?
Some, you know, vitamins.
That, yeah, what do you have in the way of oxygen you can share? You know, that might be.
Are you actually talking with people about that? Anything that
the lunar village? Not really. But I think again, that's okay because it's not quite yet in sequence. So, you know, the first thing we need to do is build a really capable lunar landing vehicle and send rovers there to go into these dark craters, which is a completely doable mission, and actually be sure of what's there and in what quantities and how hard it's going to be to extract and so on. We need to know what the resources of the moon are. We have great evidence now because of different kinds of radar and spectroscopic analysis that people have been able to do, but we really do need to go visit there, and we can do that with robot craft without any problem.
Would Blue Origin get into the rover business, or would it strictly be...
We will do anything we need to do. I hope we don't need to do any of it. I want other people to do it, but if need be, we'll do it.
So, any last words that you have for the National Space Society fans?
No, I got to meet with, some of them are in the room now, I got to meet with a bunch of teenagers and college students and younger kids briefly earlier today, and it was very inspiring for me. This is that generation of people who are going to take this heavy lifting infrastructure that we, this generation, are going to build, and they're going to put it to great use. It's totally inspiring, and the only thing I would ask everybody in this room to do is to keep educating people about how important this work is, not just that it's a fun thing to do. Of course it's a great adventure. Of course humans like to explore, and we should, and there's nothing wrong with that, but it's more than that. It's essential for your children and your children's children. You might not need it, actually. You might be fine. You're going to live out your life on this earth, and it is going to sustain you, and you're not going to have to do weird things. That won't be true of your grandchildren or their grandchildren, so we do have to focus on it.
Well, very well. Thank you. I've really loved this time just chatting with you, Jeff, and I think everybody here has loved it too, and especially all the fans of The Expanse, and so that great gift. So
that was
so
Jeff
much.
Bezos, the Amazon CEO and founder of the Blue Origin Space Venture. He was talking this weekend at the National Space Society with Alan Boyle, GeekWire's aerospace and science editor. For more of Alan's coverage, go to geekwire.com/space, where you can also find a transcript of this conversation. Follow Alan on Twitter at B0YLE. That's at B0YLE. And be sure to subscribe to the GeekWire podcast wherever you listen. I'm GeekWire editor Todd Bishop. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you on the moon.